From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Comedy Week continues. We talk with comic and actor Richard Belzer. He now co-stars in the TV series Homicide. Also a comic and actor who specializes in neurosis, Richard Lewis. Then a comic who couldn't stand stand-up, Larry David. He went on to co-create one of TV's most popular and innovative sitcoms, Seinfeld. The character George is based on David. And former Seinfeld writer Carol Leifer tells us about a real-life experience of hers that ended up on the show, and she pays tribute to the blue comics of the 50s and 60s. Leifer has a new sitcom that premieres next month. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. North Korea has broken off talks over its missile sales and weapons buildup. The delay came a day after the North Korean ambassador to Egypt defected to the United States with his brother and their families. They were granted asylum. U.S. officials say the diplomat could offer a lot of information about the North's missile sales abroad. President Clinton says he's disappointed. The United States says North Korea offered no explanation for the delay. A federal grand jury has indicted former Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy on charges he took favors from large food producers. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
An independent counsel investigating President Clinton's first agriculture secretary said a grand jury produced a 39-count indictment. Mike Espy is accused of accepting illegal gifts and favors from some of the very companies his agency regulates. Some of the corporations have already agreed to pay sizable fines. Sun Diamond Growers of California paid $1.5 million earlier this year because the company gave Espy a trip to the U.S. Open tennis tournament. The giant banking and securities firm Smith Barney paid $1 million because one of its employees arranged for a $2,200 ticket to the Super Bowl. Today's indictment says that in all, Espy accepted $35,000 worth of illegal gratuities, allegedly he tried to cover up by lying to investigators and asking a subordinate to falsify documents. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Washington.
The Haitian immigrant who alleges he was tortured by New York City police officers has reportedly increased the amount of damages he's seeking in his suit against the city. Abner Louima has reportedly raised the amount from $55 million to $465 million. Louima's attorney says that's a substantial increase, but the officers charged in the attack and the city should be punished. Heavy fighting in northwestern Cambodia today left two Thai soldiers dead when several artillery rounds strayed across the border into Thailand. Thai troops returned warning shots. From Beijing, NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports.
The fighting in northwestern Cambodia today was the most intense in 2 weeks. Troops loyal to ousted co-prime minister Prince Norodom Ronarit held their hilltop positions and rained artillery and small arms fire down on the troops of co-prime minister Hun Sen. It was Hun Sen who ousted Ronarit in a violent coup in early July. Ever since, he has been trying to wipe out any remaining resistance. But even after being driven back to the Thai border, Ronarit's troops have fought on. Thai forces are not taking sides, but they made it clear with warning shots today that they will strike back if the fighting continues to stray into Thailand. Mary Kay Magstead, NPR News, Beijing.
On Wall Street, the Dow has fallen more than 36 points to 77.45. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, stocks are lower in volatile trading on Wall Street today. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
The Dow is lower for the fifth straight session. Today's decline is being led by computer-related issues. Hewlett-Packard has fallen after the New York Times reported that HP's joint venture with Intel to design a new computer chip has plenty of opportunity for problems. And Novell is lower for the first time this week after the company's chairman squashed speculation that Novell may be taken over by IBM. Against the backdrop of today's trading is word that the world's largest mutual fund is being closed to new investors at the end of next month. Fidelity Investments is limiting its flagship Magellan Fund to existing shareholders in an attempt to improve performance of the $63 billion fund. I'm Doug Krisner.
A regional director of the International Monetary Fund says he believes Thailand's central bank will lose between $11.5 and $15 billion. The bank failed in its effort to prop up the Thai currency over this past summer. Hudson Foods continues to shop around for a new customer to replace Burger King, which cut ties with a beef supplier after its Nebraska beef production plant closed. Federal officials demanded the Hudson closure after an outbreak of E. coli bacteria, which can lead to death. If Hudson cannot find another customer, it may be forced to sell the Nebraska plant. Despite the outbreak of illness, analysts say Hudson probably won't have trouble selling the plant. No slaughtering was done there, and regulators say the bad beef was probably provided by one of Hudson's beef suppliers. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach, with over 170 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is Comedy Week on Fresh Air, getting in a few last laughs before the summer season ends. We open today's show with Richard Belzer. He's done stand-up in the big and small comedy clubs around the country and wrote the book, How to Be a Stand-Up Comic. In the early days of Saturday Night Live, he warmed up the audiences before the broadcast. He went on to perform on the late-night shows and has hosted his own comedy show and comedy specials. He's an actor as well as a comic. Belzer now plays Detective Munch on the TV series Homicide. Here's an excerpt of our 1987 interview.
You must be used to handling absolutely everything and anything. For 5 years in the mid-70s, you were the MC at Catch a Rising Star, comedy club. So you must have learned how to handle everything, including the craziest hecklers.
Yeah, well, when I first started, I didn't talk to the audience at all. I just introduced the acts. And then as time went on, I realized that I had to address the audience and asking people where they're from, what they're wearing, about who they're with. And it just kind of evolves. And sometimes you discover, sometimes I initiate it, and sometimes there are hecklers. So there are all different kinds of hecklers. Some people are very innocent. They just want to be a part of the show, and they think they're helping the comedian. Some people are mean-spirited drunks who want to disrupt the show. Some people are disruptive without even knowing it. I mean, it's just everything you could possibly imagine. Like relatives, I guess. Good analogy.
You said sometimes you would initiate it. How so?
Well, if I come out on stage, I don't usually like to start with prepared remarks. I usually just come out and say hello to the audience. And then if I see someone who looks interesting in the front row, a couple or a person, I'll ask them where they're from, and then I'll ask them what they do, and then I'll ask them all different kinds of questions to elicit responses, and then ad-lib and improvise off of the information they give me.
You've seen a lot of bad comics perform.
Yes.
What are some of the mistakes you've seen them made that you've learned from?
Well, a lot of them make the mistake that I made when I first started, and that's to rush your material when you're not getting a laugh, to speed it up. And that's the death knell. That's the worst thing you can do, is to speed up the material. What I used to do, my fatal flaw, was I would get mad at the audience for not laughing, not thinking it was me. So I would get hostile towards the audience for not laughing, and it just kind of built into this trap that I would put myself in and had to kind of verbally dance my way out of. But I soon realized that the thing to do is to take your time and not rush the material. I'd say that's the number one rule.
When you were angry at the audience for not laughing, what would you say to them?
I can't say it on the radio.
That bad.
But that period in my career didn't last too long, though. That was just like a few weeks when I first started. I realized what I was doing, because I would tape my act. A big thing with comedians when I started, I hope they're doing it now, is recording your act every night, and then you could listen back to it and see where you rushed and see where you got the laughs and see what works and what doesn't, and it's invaluable.
Well, let me ask you about your life and how you got into comedy. Now, I know you grew up in a housing project.
Yes.
And I've read that you didn't have a lot of money when you were growing up.
No.
And I assume that you were one of the funny kids in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Was that a kind of protective shield for you, being funny? Did that mean that you weren't going to be picked on by the toughest kids around?
Well, it's interesting. My wit has saved me more than once. And I found when I was a kid that a lot of the tough guys in the school liked my wit. So I would hang around with some tough guys, and we would come across some other people, and I would, like, put them down, and they'd go to beat me up, and my friends would beat them up. So I never really had to get in any fights, really, because I would, like, kind of instigate a fight, and then Vinny or Rocco or Vito would do the rest.
Instigate through verbal abuse?
I sound like a little fascist, don't I?
Yes,
but that's when I was a little, you know, I was young. It was 30 years ago. I was a young, skinny kid.
Now, you've said in one of your routines that when you were young, your mother used to beat you and that you would try to tell her jokes to get her to stop.
Right, right. Well, she was the toughest audience I ever had.
Yeah.
And my kitchen was the toughest room I ever worked.
Well, how true is that, though?
Actually, it's quite literally true. It didn't work as much as legend has it. But I when I was a kid, I had a crew cut, or a zip, what they called then, very short hair, and I looked just like Jerry Lewis. And I used to do a Jerry Lewis impression. And sometimes my mother would get mad at me, and I'd do my Jerry Lewis shtick, and she'd laugh and forget to hit me. But I'd say that worked maybe 2 times out of 20. So she usually wound up hitting me anyway. So the material wasn't that strong.
You know, one of the many old cliches is that humor comes from pain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it sounds like it's actually kind of true in your life.
Literally and figuratively. But see, I subscribe to that theory to a point. I don't think that you can relegate a facility to be funny or any talent to a specific psychological situation. I think there has to be talent that is naturally intrinsic to the person. And then if there's a psychological situation that makes it come out. I mean, I don't think that every kid that was hit grew up to be a great boxer or a great,
great
comedian.
Yeah.
But I think there has to be something there, and the two work together.
I know exactly what you mean. Now, you've also said in your routines that you were thrown out of every school that you went to. Does that include college? Were you thrown
out of
college?
Yes, I was thrown out of college. It was funny because one of the reasons I was thrown out is because I led a demonstration in 1964, before there were Vietnam War demonstrations. This was like the wimpiest demonstration. We wanted to have women be able to visit the boys' dorms, or the boys visit the women's dorms, I forget. So I got all the guys in my dorm to like march over to the women's campus, you know, like clapping our hands, you know. And the security guard, whose name was Joe, and we all knew him, he came over to the crowd, the mob, and he said, "All right, guys, come on, let's go, break it up." And we said, "Okay, Joe." And that was the demonstration. There was no bomb throwing. There was no Mario Savio. There was no...
For this, you got thrown out of college?
Well, that was on my record that, you know, I led a demonstration. I broke curfew. I had liquor in the dorm. How bad can you be in 1964?
Right, right. Now, then you went into the Army.
Yes, and I was thrown out of the Army, too. Well, I was actually discharged under honorable conditions for being too funny to carry a gun. So wait a minute, this guy's too funny. He's too funny, which is almost true. Actually, I got out of the Army by feigning mental illness, if you will. I pretended that I was suicidal, and I staged this whole thing where I said I got beat up and my back was hurting, and they found out I was faking, and they sent me to the Jewish chaplain in the Army. I didn't know there were Jewish chaplains. I thought Pat O'Brien was the... I didn't know Jews joined the Army. I didn't know Jews were, let alone chaplains. And I went to this rabbi, and I said, "Rabbi," because my sergeant said that you you got to go see your chaplain, Belzer, because you need help. So I went to the chaplain. I said, "Chaplain, with all due respect, I think I need to see a psychiatrist." And he said, "You know, Freud was a Jew, and the reason he became a psychiatrist was to discover his Jewishness. You don't need a psychiatrist. You need to discover why you're a Jew." And he lectured me on kosher food and choirs, and how I could sing in the Army Jewish choir and eat kosher food. And I said, "Really, Rabbi, I need to see a psychiatrist." He said, "Do you have a girlfriend?" I said, "No." He said, "Did you ever have?" I said, "Yeah." "Was she Jewish?" "Good." Like, everything was revolved around Judaism, which was the farthest thing from my mind then. I just wanted to get out of the Army. Finally, I was allowed to go to the psychiatrist, and I, having had a little college, I knew every freshman psychology phobia. So I said that I went to bed, I was suicidal, I hated my mother, I was afraid of women. I just did every cliche in psychology, and I got out.
That's
amazing. I hope no one's listening.
That's probably
from
one
the
of
Pentagon.
Your, one of your most convincing performances.
Yeah, and I never do this on stage. Maybe I should tell them my Army story on stage.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah. There's a lot more. I mean, it's a 40-minute story. I'm really brutally paraphrasing the story.
Did you ever think to yourself, what happens if I'm discovered that this is just an act?
What's that?
When you were trying to get out of the Army and faking
all
this stuff.
Well, I think that it's kind of like partially, you know, they knew that I was acting crazy, but I was crazy to do that in the first. It was kind of like that, you know. It was like,
right. If you could do this so well, who wants you around?
Exactly.
Anyways?
It was like Kafka meets Catch 22 or something.
I think the very first time I saw you perform was on Saturday Night Live, and you were doing your impression of Bob Dylan in like a retirement center, singing in a Yiddish accent.
Right. Well, the 86-year-old Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Now, I hate to ask questions like,
sure,
how did that idea come to you? But really, how did that idea come to you?
Well, when I was a kid, I hate to say that Bob is that much older than me, but well, when I was a teenager, and we started first getting into Bob Dylan, and we found out his real name is Zimmerman, and he's a Jew from Minnesota, and this was like a revelation to have a hero that's a Jew. So I said, if his name is Zimmerman, he must have had a bar mitzvah. So I fantasized what Bob Dylan's bar mitzvah must have been like, you know. Baruch Atadonai Eloheinu Melech Olam Asher Kiddushanu B'mitzvosav. And then he gets older, you know. Oi, oi, once upon a time, you dress so fine, you threw the bums a dime in your prime, didn't you? People called Shady Verdal, you're bound to fall, you thought they was all kidding you. And so on.
Oh, who spoke Yiddish in your family?
Actually, I just got back into Yiddish music. I've discovered these things. Everyone in my family spoke Yiddish, but I resent the fact that they didn't share, they didn't teach me, they didn't teach my brother or my cousins. My parents would talk in Yiddish, my grandparents would talk in Yiddish, and there's a comedian who does a routine, I can't think of who it is, but where it's true, if I may borrow the routine without crediting the person. And that is that Jewish families had the habit, the adults would tell a joke. They'd be telling a joke in English, and then a kid would walk in the room, and then they do the punchline in Yiddish. They say, so the guy walks up to the maid, he opens the door, he sees that she has no clothes on, and then a kid walks in the room, and he goes, Achel v'shin v'chel v'cha! And you don't know what the punch... It was the most frustrating thing I've ever... I still resent my uncles to this day for doing that to me. And I wish I could remember the comedian that did that. Maybe it was Robert Klein, but... That's not my routine, but it's a true story.
You know, since it was the older people in your family who spoke Yiddish, did you think that when you grew up, you'd automatically know the language?
That's funny, because I have a theory that everyone, when they get old, no matter what religion they are, they have a Jewish accent. Even Irish people, they get to be past 65. I want to go to the store now, because I'm in the store, good, because I can't, hello? You know, everyone, Italians, everybody, they, for some reason, they get a Jewish accent.
Richard Belzer recorded in 1987. He plays Detective John Munch on Homicide. Coming up, actor and comic Richard Lewis. This is Fresh Air. Like Richard Belzer, Richard Lewis is a comic who also has a career as an actor. He starred opposite Jamie Lee Curtis in the sitcom Anything But Love and starred with Don Rickles in the sitcom Daddy Dearest. He plays a comedy writer on the new ABC sitcom Hiller and Diller, which premieres September 23rd. Richard Lewis's stand-up comedy is often about how incredibly neurotic he is. I spoke with Lewis in 1988 when he had an HBO comedy special called I'm Exhausted. We opened with an excerpt of the special.
Thank you. You're a great audience. I wish I could feel better about feeling good, quite frankly. I'm a hypochondriac. My grandparents, they lived in a place that made me so out of it in Florida. I think the condo was called Crestfallen. That was the name of it, you know. So I feel, you know, and they bought me little gifts. I mean, well, they were very negative. We had like a little depression fair in the backyard for my birthday, and we used to throw wooden hoops around. Prescription drugs was a big thing. And they had no Tomorrowland, which is sort of a big thing, and pin the blame on the donkey was a major game in our house.
How did the I'm Exhausted show come about? Do you go around saying to friends all the time, oh God, I'm exhausted?
I said that actually, I think, to my mother moments after I was born. I just have always been exhausted for the fear that I wouldn't do enough work. That's a whole other area, isn't it? Now, I don't always go around saying I'm exhausted. I'm a good friend. If I went to a funeral, I wouldn't be insensitive and say, I'm exhausted. I had been exhausted prior to doing this special for HBO, but the problem was the special had to be done in about 2 weeks. And that was like, this should have been an episode of Nova, you know, how a Jewish man with bad posture who searches for perfection is told by executives that, fine, but we have to have it delivered in 2 weeks. And, you know, we pulled it off, I think, I don't know. But I was exhausted doing it, and I think it shows. But in a positive, affectionate way.
When do you allow yourself to take some time off? Here's what I'm thinking of. I know I'm the kind of person who, in order to take a day off, I have to have something measurable, like a temperature. You know, like, right. If I have a fever, fine, you stay home. Are you like that? I mean, do you need to have something really tangible, a real tangible problem in order to actually get some rest?
I need, basically, I get rest after a breakup from a relationship. I usually then feel I reward myself. I usually go away for a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
Without sounding, you know, tongue-in-cheek here too much. I mean, I really put a lot into relationships, and when they don't pan out, I then take a rest. I also, when I get the flu, God forbid, but when I do, it's like everything stops. I pull the phones out of my house. I don't care. I have absolutely no responsibility to anyone. I don't go to surprise parties. I'm in the bed. I'm in the bed for as long as it takes. I just feel as nauseated as I am, it's the only time I really relax.
Did you enjoy being sick when you were a kid?
Well, I did because I usually wasn't, and but people did. It was like a hypochondriacal kabuki theater I put on for the family, and I had different makeups for different ailments, of course. The flu, I felt, was the dead giveaway. I mean, it was this kabuki, very white makeup. And it was almost a mask-like effect, and it was frightening. I was half a bison, half a Jewish man, and it was, I come down to breakfast knowing that my family would shriek and then have me stay home, and they normally did.
You've done the David Letterman show a lot of times. How many times do you keep count?
I thought it was somewhere in the high 30s, you know.
Do you prepare for it when you go on?
In unbelievable fashion. It's the only reason why I have done stand-up in the last 6 years, or have given me impetus to do it, and because I never had an audience before, like on a regular basis. So I write down thousands and thousands of jokes a month. It takes me days and days to whittle it down to 30 or 40 ideas that I want to get to the show. Not to mention we ad-lib a lot on the show too, but I prepare in an enormous fashion for the show.
And I feel I had a problem sexually. I felt, ever since I grew up, I just, and we broke up, she was saying that she's bad-mouthing me to my pals.
Oh, is that
she
right?
said, I gave her an anti-climax, she was telling my friends. And I couldn't even...
That
I
could be dangerous,
oh, we couldn't even
couldn't
have foreplay. She wore like a Rupix bra when she came into the bedroom. And I blame my family. My parents, I know they made love, and yet it was like Nixon, like Watergate. They would cover it up.
Very, very, quiet
well, they,
about
they,
it,
they
yeah.
didn't want to let us hear
sure.
that they were
oh,
screaming.
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
My father would go, that's gin. He would say, that's gin.
Doesn't Letterman strike you as a pretty healthy, well-adjusted guy?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. Again, I hate to judge people's good health. I'll say this. I think so. I mean, we're such night and day together. I mean, why I think the chemistry has been effective for him and me. When I sit next to him, and I talk about my innermost feelings and certainly sexuality, I look in his face. He's only a foot away from me, and it makes me laugh because I'm not doing this to make him embarrassed, but he does get, I feel, legitimately embarrassed, and it's cute to me, but his eyes start to recede. They go back like to the Panama Canal. I can't even see his face. It's like a little off in Annie's eyes.
Can I ask you what your bar mitzvah was like? And here's why I ask it. For a lot, I mean, a bar mitzvah is, in Jewish terms, it's a religious ceremony to mark the beginning of manhood.
So right.
But for a lot of people, it's like their first opening act, you know, like their first initiation into show business. Because like you're the star of the show. There's a band. There's an MC. You know, everybody in your family gets to dance and everything. And you're the star. Was it like what kind of a mitzvah did you have?
Spielberg could not have done justice to what I had. First of all, my father, who has passed on, was the greatest caterer in the area, New Jersey and in parts of New York. He was really a genius. So, of course, he catered my bar mitzvah. It got off on a low self-esteem note that my father was booked up on the weekend for my bar mitzvah. I had to settle for a Tuesday afternoon.
You're kidding.
Early evening bar mitzvah party. Unheralded in the Torah. I mean, I heard Moses grumbling, well, how can he do that to his son, rah? But what happened was, I understood, you know, he had a job to do, and Tuesday night was sort of hip, now that I think of it. But before the party, I had to, the Saturday before, I had to read what they call the Haftorah, or Haftorah, I'm very bad with the accents here. But what happened was that I started screwing up a little bit, and I saw some of the congregation getting a little uneasy, and then I started doing stand-up. I went, oh, I'm kidding, Jonah and the Whale, come on. And I started playing the temple like a lounge.
Richard Lewis recorded in 1988.
I mean, I don't mind being with the family on Hanukkah, because being on the road, like I was in the Deep South about 2 years ago on Hanukkah, they thought, I swear to God, they thought Hanukkah was a duck call. That's all I know. It's like, Hanukkah, pull, shoot. That's all, you know. I tiptoed around the Deep South on Hanukkah. I just want a sandwich. I'll be fine. Just let me have a sandwich. But Hanukkah, Christmas, we didn't know what we were, quite frankly. It was sort of a, I really don't know what we were. We had like a, there was a Christmas tree, and yet it was a Hanukkah bush. It was sort of like a, sort of like an elephant man kind of thing there. It was like, they had balls hanging down, and yet there was like a picture of gold in my ear sort of over here. It wasn't Hanukkah, it wasn't Christmas, it was Chronica. We had Chronica.
Richard Lewis's new sitcom, Hiller and Diller, premieres on ABC September 23rd. If Lewis had a theme song, it could be High Anxiety, a song written by Mel Brooks for his movie of the same name. Lewis co-starred in the Brooks film Robin Hood, Men in Tights. Here's Mel Brooks. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
High anxiety whenever you're near. High anxiety, it's you that I fear. My heart's afraid to fly, it's crashed before. But then you take my hand, my heart starts to soar. Once more, high anxiety, it's always the same. Anxiety, it's you that I blame. It's very clear to me, I've got to give in. My anxiety, you win.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the co-creator of The Seinfeld Show, Larry David. Then comic Carol Leifer talks about writing for the series, and she pays tribute to the blue comics of the 50s and 60s. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Comedy Week continues with Larry David. He and Jerry Seinfeld co-created the sitcom Seinfeld. David also served as executive producer and head writer. He left the series about a year ago. Larry David got his start doing stand-up and briefly wrote for Saturday Night Live. You'd think that the TV show Seinfeld came directly from Jerry Seinfeld's life, but in 1992, I asked if the stories really came from Larry David's life.
I would say for the most part, probably that's true, yes.
Is there a character that you feel is closest to you?
Well, George is pretty much based on me.
Describe the character for our listeners who haven't
seen
the show.
Except I'm a lot sicker than George is.
More neurotic? Wow.
Yes. I would love to have George's life. Describe George's character?
Yeah.
Well, he's just a person who has difficulty in getting up in the morning and putting his clothes on. And starting from there, everything else is a problem for him, particularly women.
Yes, this
having
is
a relation.
This is the kind of guy who, when he finally gets to go home with a woman who he's really interested in, he finds out that the bathroom's right next to the bedroom, and he has a nervous stomach, and the whole thing is horribly embarrassing, so he has to leave.
So he leaves, exactly, yeah.
Did this come out of your life?
I have to say, yes, it did come out of my life. And I did leave, yeah. But I managed to patch things up with her the next day.
You explain?
I never really got into detail about it, no, but things I did patch things up.
Now, Jerry Seinfeld seems pretty unneurotic for a comic.
Yes, that's true. That's true. He's an anomaly. Seinfeld is. And I don't know how he got that way. I would switch places with him in a second.
But he wouldn't, right? That's what's holding the switch up.
No, he wouldn't. Yeah.
So how do you and Jerry Seinfeld know each other?
We know each other from doing stand-up. Jerry and I met probably around 1976 or 77 in one of the clubs. And we became very good acquaintances.
How did you get hooked up doing the show together?
Well, Jerry approached me in a nightclub in one of the comedy clubs in New York and told me that NBC was interested in doing a show with him, not necessarily a show, actually, a special. And we went to a coffee, we had a cup of coffee and talked about a couple of things and came up with this idea.
What was the idea as you originally described it to the network?
The idea was that it was an idea for the special, which would be a 90-minute special. A few years ago, once a month, when Saturday Night Live wasn't on, they were doing 90-minute shows. I think they're doing wrestling or something. And they wanted Seinfeld to do one of those Saturday nights for 90 minutes. And we came up with the idea that he would be going on The Tonight Show. His manager books him on The Tonight Show, and the show would be in a couple of weeks. And he doesn't have any new material to do on the show, so we were going to see how he came up with his material for this Tonight Show spot. And then at the end of the special, he would actually do the material on The Tonight Show, and that was the idea for the special. And that is what eventually has evolved into this.
Well, in each episode of Seinfeld, we still see Seinfeld doing some of his stand-up act, which is
right.
Usually related in some way to what's been happening to him through the episode.
Right. Basically, the premise of the show is still that we see how Jerry comes up with his material.
How do you work out the differences between the real Jerry Seinfeld and the Jerry Seinfeld character on TV? They have the same name, but I'm sure they're not the same person.
Well, to tell you the truth, they're very close to the same person. Generally, Jerry doesn't do anything on television that he wouldn't do in life. Well, I guess that's not true if I really thought about the shows, but for the most part, they're pretty close. I don't think Jerry would be able to tell you the difference. I can't.
Well, that must be hard to write for, because you could come up with an idea that would be a lot of fun, but Seinfeld could say, yes, but it's not really me.
Well, that happens all the time. I could give you a couple of examples of that.
Why don't you?
Well, for example, last year we did a show where the they were in a restaurant having dinner, and a menu caught on fire at the next table. And the manager came over to the table and said, "What happened?" And George explained to the manager that the busboy left the menu too close to the candle. A few minutes later, the busboy got a dressing down from the manager and was fired. And then that really started the show, because then George felt that he was responsible for getting the busboy fired. So he had to go to the busboy's apartment, at which point he left the door open and the cat escaped. Well, that idea was initially for Jerry, but Jerry felt like he wouldn't go to the busboy's house, whereas George would go to the busboy's house. So, you know, little things like that happen all the time.
Why not change the character's name so it's Jerry Schmidt or something, not Jerry Seinfeld, so that he wouldn't have to feel that it has to be him?
Jerry has such an aversion to acting, I think, that he just wants to be himself. And I don't think he could do it if we changed his name.
Now, you used to do stand-up.
Yes, that's true.
When did you start doing it, and what was your act like?
I started doing it in 1975, and it's hard to describe what my act was like, because very often I would leave in the middle of it. As soon as I saw somebody in the audience just make a face, or somebody talk to the person next to them, I would become infuriated and throw the microphone down and leave.
That was it? You just...
I would get in fights with the audience if they weren't laughing. I was like the McEnroe of comedy. I couldn't stand adversity. Yeah, but that's pretty much what would happen. I would be in the middle of a show and I would just walk off.
So with a reputation like that, who would hire you?
Nobody. And see, no one. No one would hire me. But I did I was able to perform at the Showcase Clubs, because they liked me. They didn't care if I walked off.
They probably weren't paying you anyways, right?
That's exactly the point. Right. Yeah, they weren't.
Why would you walk off? Why were you so easily discouraged when somebody wouldn't laugh or would heckle?
Because I'm a baby. I'm a big baby, and I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand like losing. It was like winning and losing. And if I lost to the audience, I couldn't take it. I would throw the board over.
Well, did you ever kill on stage?
Oh yes, yeah, I did. Yeah, very very often, in fact.
And you'd complete those sets.
Those I would complete, yeah, and that was always an exhilarating feeling for me. And I'm going to do it again, too, so.
You can do stand-up again?
Yes.
Soon?
As soon as the show's over, I think.
So, what was your act like?
It wasn't anything like Jerry's. First of all, it was completely disjointed, very eclectic. I would talk about a lot of really... really personal things, and also a lot of farcical, absurd things. And I can't really say what it was about. It was mostly about me, I guess.
Give me a sense of something really personal that you'd reveal about yourself in the act.
Do you want me to tell you something?
Sure.
Oh, gee. Oh. I don't know. I guess... oh, impotency, maybe. Not that I'm impotent now, but perhaps I would talk about an experience that I had. Things like that.
Well, this helps give me a sense of why you'd walk off. I mean, really, if you're revealing things that are pretty personal and somewhat embarrassing, and somebody doesn't laugh, I could see why you might want to leave.
Oh, so you could understand that?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, see, there you go.
Yeah, because a lot of comics aren't that personal.
No, well, I don't know. It's It's hard for me to describe my act. I don't really know what it was. It was a lot of the things that you see on the show, too, also. A lot of the situations would you could find in my act, I think.
You were with Saturday Night Live for 84 to 85, is that right?
Yes, yes, one season.
What were some of the sketches you wrote?
They only did, they only put on the air one sketch of mine the entire season.
Which one?
No one in the world wouldn't know what it was, except maybe a few people in my family. The sketch was on, it was the last sketch of a show that Ed Begley Jr. was the host of. And the show, the sketch was on at 5 to 1 in the morning. And Ed Begley Jr. played an architect, and Harry Shearer was the developer. And Harry Shearer was looking over the plans for the new building that Ed Begley had designed. And he saw, he said, he was looking over the blueprint, and he said to Ed Begley, what's this thing over here? And Ed Begley said, oh, that's the elevator. And then Harry Shearer said, no, but what's this? And he said, oh, that's a stool for the elevator man to sit. And then Harry Shearer said that a stool? He didn't want his elevator men sitting on stools. And they just got in a fight, and that that was the sketch. It's pretty stupid.
I don't remember it.
No, I'm sure you don't.
Yeah. How is it that you worked there for a whole year and or a whole season and only got one sketch on?
Because Dick Ebersole didn't like my material. He was the executive producer. Dick and I didn't quite get along. Dick and I had a few problems.
Did you feel like, what's the point of staying if your material isn't going to get on?
Yes, yes. In fact, I actually quit the show, and there's a Seinfeld episode that's based on this. One day I walked into Ebersole's office. It was like right before one of the shows was about to start. He had cut one of my sketches after dress rehearsal. And I walked up to him right before airtime, 10 minutes before airtime, and I walked up to myself, that's it, I'm finished, I quit, I've had it, I'm never coming back here again, it's over, done, I hate this place, I quit. So I left the building, and I started walking home, and I felt very good. I quit the show, I wasn't going to put up with that, and I got home, and I started thinking about my salary and how much money I was giving up. And I go, let's see, that's 3,000 there, that's 15, 20, that's $40,000. What am I out of my mind? I'm going to give this guy $40,000. It's another couple of weeks. What am I, crazy? You know? So on Monday morning, I went back in and pretended that the whole thing never happened. And I went into the meeting. I said good morning to everybody. People gave me some strange looks. And Ebersole never said another word to me about it, so I just continued working there. But I wrote an episode for Seinfeld about it last year when George quit his job.
Larry David, thanks a lot for talking with us. And if I ever get the chance to see you perform live, I'll be sure to laugh.
Yeah, either that or bring your earplugs or a bulletproof vest or something. Well, thanks very much. I enjoyed it.
Larry David co-created Seinfeld and is the former executive producer and head writer of the show. Coming up, a comic who has written for Seinfeld and is about to debut in her own sitcom, Carol Leifer. This is Fresh Air. Kara Leifer is a comic, actor, and writer. She's written for Seinfeld and has been a friend of Jerry Seinfeld since she started doing stand-up in the late 70s. She's been a frequent guest on The Letterman Show and has had her own comedy specials. Now Leifer is the executive producer and star of a new sitcom called All Right Already that premieres September 7th on the Warner Brothers Network. I spoke with her in 1993 at the time of her Showtime special Gaudy, Bawdy, and Blue. She wrote, starred in, and co-produced this mock documentary about a fictional comedian named Rusty Berman, who was popular in the 60s for her risque humor. The program opened with Leifer, as Rusty Berman, at a nightclub in the 60s, wearing a sequin dress. She seated at the piano doing her act.
Did you hear about the woman ironing her brassiere? Her husband says, "What the hell are you ironing that for? You got nothing to put in it." She says, "I iron your shorts, don't I?" Did you hear what Lord Godiva said to Lady Godiva? "Where the hell have you been, you rat bastard? Your horse got home 2 hours ago." She's the yellow rose of Texas. She charges $50, the richest girl in Texas. And all she does is sews. Laugh loud, or I'll sing clean songs.
Who are some of the comics you're paying tribute to in this mock documentary?
Probably mostly it was based on a woman named Rusty Warren, who was very popular in the 50s and early 60s. She had an album called Knockers Up that actually sold, I believe it's 8 million copies, Terry.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, and also women like Pearl Williams was another woman that was around then doing that kind of comedy. And other people have come up to me with other names of women that were around who did this style of cabaret comedy. And it really fascinated me, especially Rusty Warren, since she was so popular and yet so out of sync with the time in that it was a true underground kind of popularity.
So what made you think about these comics recently?
I guess mostly that, being a woman comedian and knowing what that's like in the current comedy scene, thinking about what it must have been like 30 years ago. You know, on Miami Beach in the late 50s, you know, Rusty Warren did a 4 a.m. show. I just really, I get such a kick out of that's what, you know, the nightlife was like then, that, you know, it's 3:30, got to run down to the show, you know, 4 a.m. And that, you know, they worried about being busted and... when Pearl Williams played Carnegie Hall, I believe either she got arrested or, you know, cops were in the background. It was a real dangerous element to comedy. It was, you know, real Lenny Bruce-like kind of comedy.
Did you write the jokes for Gaudy, Bawdy, and Blue, or did you get some of them from the old records?
Well, actually, my dad is, you know, king of the joke tellers.
Mm-hmm.
And
I thought my dad was king of the joke tellers.
Well, actually, on our little piece of Long Island, I have to say, my dad laid claim. But, he's the type of guy who's, give me any subject, throw out a subject, I got a joke for it. So, he's semi-retired now, so I called him before I was going to do the special. I said, "Dad, get a tape recorder, put a tape in, and every dirty joke, you know, put on a tape." So I really credit my dad with giving me a lot of the material. But, you know, a lot of the jokes are from those type of comedy albums. But even, you know, joke telling is a dying art form. You know, the two guys walk into a bar and that kind of thing. And I like that part of it, too. That, you know, part of comedy intrigues me, too. And it's sad to me that it's really kind of dying out.
Wait, would you tell the one about the guy who has 6 hours to live?
Oh, yeah, that's actually one of my favorite jokes of all time. So a guy comes home from the doctor. Wife says, "What did the doctor say?" And the guy says, "Doctor says I have 6 hours to live." So wife says, "What would you like to do?" He says, "How about sex?" So they have some sex. She says, "All right, what would you like to do now?" He says, "How about some more sex?" She says, "Okay." They do it again. Little while later, she says, "All right, what would you like to do now?" He says, "How about sex one more time?" She says, "Look, I got to get up in the morning." But, you know, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. I'll be here all week.
Now, can you tell this kind of joke in your own performances?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think if you go to the improv, you know, you're expecting, you know, Shecky. You know, I mean, if you go to, I went to the Concord Hotel with my family last year. And yeah, that's where, you know, you see these kind of guys who get up and do that kind of comedy. But, you know, it's dying. It's really kind of gone. It's really, even, you know, in the special as Rusty Berman, when she's being interviewed, you know, she says, you know, the kids today with the, did you ever notice this and you ever notice that? No, I never noticed. You know, tell me a joke. You know, I've heard that from older comedians over the years. You know, I think this kind of style of comedy that's prevalent now kind of baffles them, because to them, you know, comedy is, you know, two guys walk into a bar and that, you know, that's what a show is.
My guest is Carol Leifer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Carol Leifer. I spoke with her in 1993 when she was writing for the sitcom Seinfeld.
Yeah, I was originally a program consultant, and now I'm a story editor. And they're all titles that are just mean writer.
Writer at different salaries, maybe?
Right. Different food chain salary levels.
Now, you and Seinfeld used to actually be a couple, right?
Yes, we dated briefly.
When was that?
1977, it's got to be.
So does this make you Elaine?
No, actually, people would think that probably since Jerry and I went out. But no, actually, the character of Kramer is based on me. well, Jerry and I dated, and then since then we've been great, great friends. So I think that people would kind of maybe think that, but, you know, Julia has really, really made Elaine her own. But I guess that it's natural for people to think that since we're friends who used to go out.
Have there been any storylines that did come out of your experiences together?
No, I wouldn't say any specifically. No, but working there now, they really like real life experiences and translating that to the show. You know, they really want to keep it on a real plane. So I try to think, and everybody who writes at the show, you know, now I find myself doing a lot of things that I maybe wouldn't do before, because I always think, well, I could get a story idea out of it.
What have you done to get a story idea?
Well, semi-recently, a gay friend of mine asked me if I wanted to go with another gay friend of his to the Hollywood Bowl, because the guy was going with, he works in banking, and he was going with his boss, and he kind of needed a beard to go with him.
A beardette.
Yes. Beardess. So so I went with him and actually got a storyline out of it. So I was happy that I could do that.
Has that one been on yet?
No. But it is funny, because when you put yourself in these situations, it's much easier to think. You know, like I was thinking when I went to the Hollywood Bowl with this guy, you know, when he went to go to the bathroom, you know, it might have been funny if, you know, the boss and his wife then turned to me and say, you know, I hope you don't get your hopes up too high with this guy, because, you know, he's gay. And then when, you know, he comes back, you know, Elaine would be like, oh, you know, you don't know how wrong you are. We're practically living together, you know, and starts, like, making out with him. So, you know, I definitely do more things now that maybe I wouldn't necessarily, just to kind of see what happens.
Being the only woman on this staff of writers, as I believe you are you often in the position of having to give the female point of view and saying, nah, a woman wouldn't do that?
Well, besides getting coffee for the guys. yeah, and actually, sometimes, even really very small ways, I was just working in my office once, and Jerry called me from downstairs and said, what's a really fancy type of woman's shoe? What's a nice shoe? You know, I said, oh, I don't know, like slingback pumps? Yeah, that sounds good. Okay, thanks, you know. So sometimes it's really in small ways like that.
Well, I wanted to ask you, you had dated Jerry Seinfeld, as we mentioned. You also used to date Paul Reiser, who now has his own network show. I figure, like, the network should give sitcoms to your boyfriends or something.
Right. Right. If anybody wants to get a network spot, my number is 555.
So did you leave Paul for Jerry?
I dated a lot of comedians in those days. I'm not exactly what my route of flight map was like then, but, you know, when you're around comedians and they're really the only people that you see, you know, during your evenings, you're bound to date a few of them.
Right. Tara Liefer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Hey, Terry.
Yeah?
A pleasure.
Kara Liefer recorded in 1993. She's the star and executive producer of the new sitcom All Right Already. It premieres September 7th on the Warner Brothers Network. She plays Carol Lerner, who runs a stylish optical boutique in South Beach, Florida, where she's perched between the ultra-hip and golden oldies crowd. Fresh Air's Comedy Week continues tomorrow. We'll close with Jonathan and Darlene Edwards, the comic alter egos of Joe Stafford and Paul Weston. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
In the springtime, I love Paris in the fall. I love Paris in the winter when it drizzles. I love Paris in the summer when it sizzles. I love Paris every moment, every moment of the year. I love Paris.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.